Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Suspense Radio. We want to welcome all of you when you're listening, how you're listening, wherever you're listening. Thank you again so much for tuning in to Suspense Radio. Today's show is 90 minutes, three fantastic authors. Many of them, or three of them that you should know already, and if you don't, shame on you, because we're going to kick it off with Stephen James, of course, with the Bowers Files, and he has a new book coming out in his Jevon Banks series, November 1st. We're going to get into that, followed by Alan Jacobson, of course, and his Karen Bale series. And then Amy Lignor is out. She was mainly young adult. She has written in her Talent Lowry series, Adult, and we are excited to speak with her about that. So, without any further ado, let's sit back, relax, and enjoy, because 90 Minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now. Everybody, welcome back here to Suspense Radio. We are going to jump in with our first guest, master storyteller, and that is a master's in storytelling. Stephen James, like I said, he is back with his book that comes out November 1st called Singularity. It's the second in his Jevon Banks series. The first was Placebo. You also might know him, of course, for his Patrick Bowers series, and I guess you want to say his chess books. So we want to welcome Stephen to the show. So, Stephen, again, thank you so much for coming on. How you doing, man?
Hey, I'm doing great. It's great to be here again.
Yeah, and then I think this is like your fourth or fifth time on the radio. It's fabulous to always have you on because you are one of the hardest working men in writing, especially this year with all the stuff you got going on. And November 1st is your last book coming out of the year, your second in your Jevon Banks books. I remember talking to you about Jevon Banks, about, gosh, I think it was 3 years ago at Thriller Fest when you had the Placebo idea, and now that came about. So let us know about Singularity and how Jevon is moving forward.
Well, yeah, he's a real interesting kind of character. He's one of the world's greatest escape artists, and in Placebo, of course, he was trying to overcome the death of his wife and his two sons who his wife had actually killed his two boys in the beginning of the book, and so he's recovering from that. And the series is different from my Patrick Bauer series, mainly because it's a little different tone. It's not quite as dark. The crimes aren't quite as grisly, but the characters, kind of a full cast of interesting, intriguing characters. And now with Singularity, it's interesting because just a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. government announced that Area 51 actually did exist, and so Singularity came out at a good time because it has to do with sneaking onto Area 51 and some conspiracies and cutting-edge medical research and magic and illusions in Las Vegas. So it's a lot of fun, and really ended up hitting at just the right time.
Yeah, I mean, Area 51, of course, is one of the most secretive places, if not the most secretive place in the world. And, of course, yeah, the government said it didn't exist for so long. But what kind of research and things did you have to go into? Because, I mean, there's a lot of conspiracy information about Area 51 and things go on. But what did you do to try to make it like another little twist and things with singularity within that part in the book?
Well, one of the things I always try to do, you know, is get as much research as I can, get stuff as realistic as possible. And so I talked to some people in the military, and they gave me as much information as they could about a place that didn't officially exist. And so a lot of what I describe is true, although, I mean, obviously some of it I had to change, you know, to fictionalize it for the story. But it was pretty fascinating a couple of weeks ago when I was checking out the news and they said, oh, okay, it actually does exist. And I thought, I wonder what it took for them to finally admit to kind of the research. And the research that I mentioned is out there and is actual research that they're trying to do with autonomous drones that can be thought controlled and can actually fire autonomously without humans in the loop. All this stuff is happening right now in the U.S. military, and it's kind of frightening where things could lead.
Yeah, I mean, I think when Area 51 became part of Google Maps, they kind of had to say, yeah, it existed, because, you know, Google's just not going to make that stuff up. I don't know any other way. I mean, everybody knew it existed. No one knows what's in there, though. That's the whole thing. It's not difficult to say, yeah, we got a place like that, but we're not going to tell you what the hell it's about. I mean, I think that's always the fascinating part of it. And it's great that you're able to explore it. And you're doing it with a way and a character. And Jevon Banks, like you said, is like an illusionist. And there's really no other character out there that has come close to being, you know, like that. I mean, it's almost like maybe putting Harry Houdini in the Thriller story and having him solve the stuff. So do you kind of, you know, go with like the Harry Houdini kind of research and all those kinds of things to create a character like Jevon Banks? Something that really hasn't been out there, and you don't have a lot of other authors to maybe fall back on
No, that's a good way to look at it. Kind of like throwing Houdini into a thriller story. And when I was working on this idea, I wanted something completely different, just like you said. Not another detective, not another CIA agent or assassin or FBI agent or whatever. I wanted something that no one had really done before, but a guy with skills that could be able to do amazing things. And so, anyway, I stumbled on this idea of using this illusionist magician guy. And so I went to Las Vegas and then to Los Angeles to do research with some actual performing illusionists and magicians and talked with them. I talked with one of the designers who does the trick designs for some of the biggest names in magic in the world. And I had him brainstorm with me how I could pull off some of the tricks that appear in Singularity. And so I remember sitting there in Las Vegas with him. I gave him the idea, and he's like, okay, here's ways we could do it. And for a couple hours, we talked through it, and I finally put that trick in the book. So when readers pick it up, they'll be like, oh, yeah, this could actually be done the way that it's described here. So the research was tons of fun. I mean, you know, telling my wife, I got to go to Las Vegas, you know, for 3 days of research. You know, it's like, could I come along? No, it's totally research, trust me.
It's totally research. And if you see anything on the, like the cheetah on there, look, I just had that. That's, again, that's just research if you see that on the credit card bill. But, you know, for let's just say for the starting off writer, someone who maybe, you know, is getting themselves wet and their feet wet because you just finished a book on writing for Writer's Digest, which is going to be out too, which is going to be a great companion for authors to have. How would they go about finding somebody like that, like magicians, to be able to go out and talk with? I mean, how are you able to kind of be able to find these people?
You know, when I started writing my first novel, it's called The Pawn. This is probably 7 or 8 years ago. I had some people that I found online that were sort of world experts in different areas of geographic profiling and research, investigative techniques, and all this kind of stuff. So I just emailed them, and I said, basically, I'm an author. I'm working on this novel. Here's who I am. You know, would you be willing to answer a couple questions? And, you know, people are thrilled to talk about stuff, especially when you say, hey, I understand you're one of the world's experts in this thing, and kind of compliment them, and then say, you know, I just had a couple questions. Could we chat on the phone, or a couple email questions? And over the years, I've found that's one of the most fun parts of writing is really doing this research. I never would have guessed it. I always thought research was sort of boring and maybe, you know, not as much fun. But interviewing some of these people has just been fascinating. I mean, I've had an opportunity to talk with some of the most interesting folks that I've ever met or ever even imagined that I would meet. So a lot of it is just asking them, and it's surprising how many people will say yes.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why we have Crime and Science Radio now with Doug Lyle and Jan Burke on Suspense Radio, and they do their shows because they offer that kind of expert information, and it's very fascinating to listen to them. And that's the one thing I think that readers and even fans don't understand is it's not all CSI. In fact, 95% of CSI is fake on the TV show, right? That stuff just doesn't happen like that. And so you've kind of now written with the FBI, and now you're kind of writing into a totally different genre. And again, you did something that was a little different. You started your second series before your first series, you know, your most popular one, I guess, Patrick Bowers. You had The King come out. What made you decide, you know what, I want to start doing Jevon Banks now when you did with Placebo last year instead of waiting until the Bowers stuff played itself out?
Well, one thing was I had these ideas for a story. For a couple of years, they'd been kind of turning around, and they just weren't ideas that would fit in with Patrick Bowers. And so I went to my publisher and basically said, you know, I've got this idea, this series idea, and, you know, it wouldn't fit in with that world that I've created for Patrick Bowers, and would you be interested? And they said, yeah, we'd love to try something a little different. And so it's been actually a good break because it's kept me fresh with Patrick Bowers. You know, The King came out. I'm working on Checkmate, which is the eighth and final book in the chess series. And so I have a feeling that I might have gotten burned out if I didn't have some other projects that were a little bit different to work on over the last couple of years. And so I think it's kept all of my writing kind of unique, fresh, a little bit different, and actually probably kept me from burning out if I would have just kept plugging along with the same series.
And, you know, fans of the Bauer series now find out that you have book two in the Jevon Banks series. And what do you tell them as far as how is Jevon Banks the same or how is he different from Patrick Bowers to get those fans to come over now and discover this whole new world that you've created?
Well, both of these guys are kind of the best at what they do. And Jevon he's incisive just as Bowers is, but he's completely different. I mean, he's not an FBI agent or anything like that. And so there's a difference in the fact of, you know, Bowers is part of law enforcement and all of that. But both of these guys are at the top of their game, both of them, whether it's in illusion or it's in geospatial investigation, there's nobody better. And just that idea of following those characters through with the mystery aspect, with the suspense aspect, both of the stories have that. But the suspense, psychological suspense, is deeper probably in the Bowers books, and there's a little bit more fun, a little bit more joking around in the Singularity book. So they actually play off from each other pretty well.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that, you know, readers like to see also. I mean, it's kind of like a band when, you know, they get a little bit, I guess, apprehensive when you see your new band kind of take a different direction. But when you're able to kind of make it work, and it's still your style, and I think that's the thing that people have to remember, just because, you know, and again, we're speaking with author Stephen James, and you can find a lot more information at stephenjames.net. The book of Singularity comes out November 1st, 2nd in the Jevon Banks series. And that's what fans got to understand is that, you know, it's still your style, even though it's a different character. And I think some authors are either afraid to jump out of what they're writing, because, of course, you see a lot of authors with the same character 20 books in, but it's refreshing to see that you're like, you know what, I think I was going to get burned out and I needed a refresher.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I've always wanted to avoid is that cookie cutter book where every book comes out, it's basically the same story, just a different name for the killer, a different love interest for the main character. And like you said, 20 books in, it's basically people telling the same stories over and over. And so with every book, even in the Bauer series, I try to take a different slant, whether it's psychological suspense or terrorism or kind of more of a mystery or uncovering things from the past and so on like that. And even with the Bank series, all of that has kept each of the books kind of different and unique and fresh. And you know, I like the analogy, you know, of a band because you've got to reinvent yourself a little bit, but you've also got to give your fans what they've come to love and look for in what you do. So there's always a balancing act there. And in order, you know, as an artist, as a creative artist, you've got to continue to, you know, test the boundaries and try out new things, or else that creativity will just dry up.
And, you know, you mentioned The King, which came out earlier this year. I believe it was like in July. And that is the second to the last book that you had in the Bauer series. And, of course, before that you had Opening Moves, which took readers all the way back to the beginning. And now you have the last two coming out. So with The King and then leading into Checkmate, did you start thinking about around the knight and around the bishop, okay, this is kind of how I wanted to end it and climax it out with the end of Checkmate, or did it just totally, you know, go into a different direction after you started writing The King and you're like, damn, I got to do something different now?
More the second one. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out. I'm still
because
trying to figure out the next
writer.
Scene. You know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just working on the next scene in the book that I'm working at. You know, Checkmate right now. And but anytime I think, you know, writers tell you, oh, I had this book planned out 5 years ago and I knew where this whole series was going, most of the time that's complete BS. You know. And if it isn't, then there's probably something wrong, because if I can think 5 years ahead of what the story would be, most likely readers can guess stuff too that's going to be coming down the pike. So no, it's completely new. In fact, just 2 days ago, as I was working on Checkmate, I had this idea for the climax, and I thought that is far better than anything I would have ever come up with. And so I'm kind of riding this wave right now of coming off this idea, trying to reshape where things are going so I can land it in a place that's going to be this huge twist at the very end. And so it'll be a great way to end the series of Checkmate.
Yeah, for people that have not had the ability to see you live and give classes like at Thriller Fest with Craft Fest and other places around, you talk a lot about how you are very much an organic writer and how you'll change a book in the middle of it when something comes up, because that's just the way that it takes you. So you can basically say that you give a little piece of your mind within every book, because literally it's all straight coming as you're typing. It like is writing itself almost.
Yeah, you know, the way I've always looked at it is, if I'm not surprised by the direction that a story goes, my readers probably won't be surprised. They're smart. I mean, my readers are pretty dialed in. They know thrillers. They know sort of the gimmicks that are out there and the way that people typically shape stories and the twists that might be coming. And so when I write, I'm trying to be aware of that stuff too and say, okay, I want to take things in a direction where no one would guess. But when it happens, they're like, I should have guessed that. I should have seen that coming. But nobody sees it coming when I'm writing it, because I didn't see it coming. It's like,
right.
Oh, okay, I could maybe pull this off. And so, yeah, my stories do change direction in the middle, and sometimes even toward the very end as I'm writing them, and I come up with something that I think would be, you know, a better ending or a bigger twist or something like that. And, you know, for me, that's one of the big things, is a huge twist at the end, either a double twist, sometimes even a triple twist ending. And those are the things that take so much time to come up with. And I might be writing a story and then come up with that twist idea that at the beginning I had no clue I would even move in that direction. So yeah, it's fun. I mean, it's always this journey of discovery. And if I outlined everything, man, it would just, I can't imagine how boring that would be.
Yeah.
Just sit down and fill in the blanks for 6 months, you know?
Yeah, and that's the one thing that you can definitely see that in as a reader, you can see that within the books. You know what? This seems a little too outlined. It's kind of like a speech. It's like it's not really from the heart. You can tell that it was written for somebody. You see all those athletes giving all these, you know, bullshit apologies. And it's like, you know what? Your PR person wrote that. It's not from the heart. And you can sense all that. And another thing, you know, that you decided to do is you decided, hey, I'm going to get into the YA part. Because, you know, that's one of the fastest growing genres, without a doubt. I mean, it just seems like, you know, adults and kids alike are jumping into YA. So what have you got going on there in the YA section now with books that you are going to have coming out?
Yeah, I actually did start a new series that'll start release this spring. The first one's called Blur, and they're thrillers for teens and pretty intense. Not paranormal, but sort of a story where you don't quite know what's going on, if it's a ghost story or if the guy's going crazy or what. So it's sort of this descent into not madness so much, but something like that, where you're not quite sure the whole way. And then there's, you know, some twists at the end that kind of pull the rug out. And so it was so much fun writing Blur, and I'm looking forward to doing the next book next spring, writing the next one. It was, you know, different, and again, kept me fresh, gave me a chance to tell a whole new story, a whole new type of story for a whole new, you know, group of readers. And I've always loved teenagers. I've got three teenage daughters of my own, and I thought this is the time to write some books for young adults, because, you know, 5 years from now, it'll be, my kids will be grown up and out of the house, and this way I can try and make it as authentic as I can.
And so did you let them kind of read your stuff along the way to be like, you know, hey, am I doing this right, or do I have this right, or do I have the dialogue right that's kind of going on in high school, or am I a little off? Were they helpful as like being editors, I guess, per se?
Yeah, actually, I had my daughters look over the book, and one of them was getting bored in this one part, and I looked at it, and I was, you know, I'm like, you're right. Yeah, I got to change it. I got to rewrite that. I got to fix that section. And it might have been okay for adults. It might have, you know, who might have liked the little extra detail and all that. But I'm like, no, got to fix this. And the cool thing with, you know, with teens is if something's not working, they'll tell you.
It's like, yeah, really.
You know, Dad, this sucks. I don't get it. What's going on? You're like, okay, cool. Thank you. But a lot of adult readers won't do that. They'll just kind of beat around the bush. Well, I thought it was pretty good and blah, blah, blah. And you're just like, no, I want it straight. And believe me, teens will give it to you straight if you give them a chance.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you've met my 16-year-old daughter, and she's not going to hold back any punches like with the magazine or anything else that we do. She'll just look at us and say, but yeah, this really does suck.
That's great.
Like,
I love
thanks, it. Honey. It's like, yeah, I appreciate that. Okay, so let's do something else. and yeah, you
exactly.
Are grounded now, but you know.
Yeah, no kidding.
I know, but I mean, so with all the stuff you have going on, and you got a lot of things, and I know that you have the On Writing. Did you want to talk a little bit about, you know, what that's going to be? When is that coming out for Writer's Digest? You did a book for them.
Yeah, I think it's going to come out in May. You can go and pre-order. It's called Story Trumps Structure. I think it's already listed on Amazon and other sites, or you can actually pre-order it if you wanted to get a copyright when it comes out. But yeah, it's sort of this whole approach of how to write great stories by breaking the rules of outlining, the rules of structure, three-act structure, all this stuff. My view is story trumps all that. Telling a great story, nobody cares how many acts it has. Nobody cares if you outline it or not. They want a great story that goes in a direction they don't expect, that satisfies them, surprises them at the end. So how do you actually do that? How do you go about writing organically? And so, yeah, this book was kind of a combination of about the last 10 or 15 years of my teaching on writing around the country and just the stuff that I've picked up as I've written novels of my own. And so it was lots of fun to write that one, and I'm looking forward to getting that out. And so when people ask me, well, what is this approach you're even talking about? And I can say, okay, here it is. Lay it out for them. Show it to them.
And so this is a book that more like a companion, where an author is writing, and they can kind of pick it up and kind of flip to a section to kind of see, you know, different things in the writing styles that they can use while they're writing a book, not just before or after or anything else in between, right?
Yeah, it'll be really helpful for people working on novels who've gotten started already and, you know, kind of maybe trying to figure out which direction to take things. Also for people who might, you know, be thinking about writing a novel, and it could probably save them a whole lot of time instead of wasting time outlining and doing all that kind of stuff, when it probably could be better spent just working on the novel and watching the story unfold as you work on it.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, I'll tell you what. We want to thank you so much for coming on. You have had an extremely busy 2013, maybe a little less 2014, but we still get to see great books coming out of you. I have to say, a little disappointed that Bowers has come to an end here, coming with Checkmate next year. That's going to be a sad time, but very excited about Jevon Banks and the direction that you're going to be going with that character. That will definitely fill a lot of reading hours coming here into the future for people. So I want to thank you for that, and thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, John. It's great to be back.
All right, so we'll talk with you later, Stephen. Enjoy yourself.
All right, I'll enjoy Tennessee.
All right, bye. So again, everybody, that is author Stephen James. You can go to stephenjames.net to find out a lot more information about the Bowers Files, to find out about his newest book, Singularity, coming out November 1st, the second in the Jevon Banks Experience. He's got YA, like he said, in May. He'll have a book on writing that he wrote for Writer's Digest. You can check all these things out. One of the greatest, I mean, he's just not only one of the greatest, nicest guys, but he is just a master storyteller, and he is definitely one that should be on, you know, people's reading lists. And if he's not, shame on you and go get them. So we want to now take a short break, and we'll be right back with our next guest. He is the author of the Karen Bale series. His latest book is No Way Out, and it is book 5 in Karen Bale, came out on September 17th, and that is none other than author Alan Jacobson, and we will speak with him when we are right back. So here you go. Welcome everybody back here after the break. And again, I want to thank Stephen James for being on the show to talk about his books. And we are going to transition now into our next guest. He's been on the show several times before, always fascinating. We love to always hear what he has going on because of his character, Karen Vale, which is one of the most exciting, I guess you want to say, heroines in thriller writing today. His latest book is called No Way Out. It is book 5 in the Karen Vale series. Came out September 17th. So while you're listening, you can hop on the computer, go to Amazon and buy it, and then you can hear the author right now, Mr. Alan Jacobson, talk about the book. So, Alan, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
Good, John. It's great to be back.
Yeah, I think it's been about a year since we had you on. You've done a lot of things. We did catch up with you at Thriller Fest for a little bit, but now we got No Way Out. Book 5 here in Karen Vale. So let us know, what the hell is she up to now?
Oh, my God. She's making trouble for the Brits, I'll tell you that. It's set in England, mostly in London, and, surrounding areas as well. And it was a blast to research, as you can imagine. I had to go to England twice. And it is a very, very exciting novel. It was not just a blast to write. I'm told it's a blast to read. So Karen Vale, what is she up to? The book opens where she's in Madrid teaching a course on behavioral analysis, because as everybody knows or will now know, she's an FBI profiler. And as everybody knows or will now know, I spent several years working with the behavioral analysis unit on a research basis, two senior profilers in particular, and I still work with them. But it's a little different because I've got the knowledge base now that I write from, and when I consult them now, it's either as a friend or as, you know, I have specific questions relevant to the story that I'm writing at the moment, rather than just, you know, general education, absorbing everything I can about behavioral analysis. So Vale is in Madrid teaching other detectives in Europe about behavioral analysis, and this is something that the behavioral analysis unit really does, because they want, number one, the world's police force to understand when they go to a crime scene and they see certain things at a homicide, they want them to know, look, you're not dealing with X offender, you're dealing with Y offender, and those types of cases need to be handled differently and managed differently and evaluated differently. So they're spreading the love, you know, educating, and it's very effective, and my buddies have done that. So I looked at how I wanted to start this novel, and I thought that would be perfect. I mean, not only is it accurate, but it gets the reader to Madrid, you know, it introduces them to Europe, and I did go to Madrid a couple of years ago, so it was a lot of fun revisiting those scenes and the places that she went to in Madrid. Then something happens in London. She is sent, actually something happens in Madrid too,
right?
Not so good for Karen Vale, but it was kind of funny for the reader. And then she's sent to London, and then all hell breaks loose, and she's there to investigate the bombing of a gallery, an art gallery in a very posh area of London. And things are not always as they seem, as they appear in my books, and this is certainly no exception. So it's a launching point for me. There are some interesting revelations about world history, and I found a way to make it interesting and exciting, because history can be a little, you know, dry.
Right.
But no, that I would never do anything like that. So it starts off with a blast, and kind of goes from there. It's a very exciting novel.
Now, you came off of what I felt, which was Inmate 1577, which was the fourth in the Karen Vale book. I think is your best work that you've ever done, and I think
Thank
a
you.
Lot of people felt that way. So did you kind of have a little extra added pressure? And is this kind of why, because it came out a couple years ago, did you have a little extra added pressure to kind of amp things up a little bit with No Way Out and taking Karen Vale now into book five?
Well, I definitely felt and feel added pressure with every book because, you know, each book I approach from a totally different perspective. I look at each story individually. What I'm trying to do is write something different each time. I'm not trying to replicate what I've done. And it's an organic process. So I don't look at it and say, oh my God, Inmate 1577 was, you know, so fantastic from X, Y, and Z perspectives. Now I'm going to try A, B, and C. It's not like that at all. It's looking at the story that I want to tell and trying to decide and find the best ways to tell that story so that it's interesting to the reader and, you know, frankly, for myself. I mean, I'm going to be spending over a year on a project. You better like it or you're going to be really bored and miserable for a year. So I never choose something that I'm not excited about. In fact, that's actually what happened with Inmate 1577. I never planned to write that book, John, and that's the first time that ever happened to me. I said to myself, well, I've written three Vale novels. I want to do something different. I have another character that I wanted to introduce, and I figured I'd give Vale a rest for a book. And I literally was walking into my office one day, and I said, Karen Vale on Alcatraz. Wow, that would be really interesting. You know, I wrote it down, and that was it. You know, nothing further came to me. And the next day, again, I walk into my office, and I said, wait, and what if, you know, and this happens. And then each day, that happened for about 3 or 4 days in a row, and this thing started to take on a mind of its own. I was getting really excited about this and going, oh, my God, this is great stuff. And as the outline started to take shape, I went, I got to write this now. You know, why not write this right now? So that's what happened. So I wrote Inmate 1577, and last year Hard Target came out. So I did give Karen Vale a rest, kind of, sort of, because she was in Hard Target and played a big role in it in terms of, you know, the investigation. And she had some terrific scenes with the new main character, Aaron Uziel, or Uzi, as we like to call him, and Hector DeSantos, who's a black operative for the Department of Defense. And he paired up with Vale in Velocity, which is the third book in the Karen Vale series. He also was introduced in The Hunted, which was my second novel ever. It was a standalone, although it's no longer a standalone because Hector DeSantos is in several of my other novels now. But Hector DeSantos and Karen Vale had a great chemistry together. And I found in Hard Target, last year's book, that the chemistry between the three of them, Vale, DeSantos, and Uzi, was just palpable. It was so great that I said, oh, I've got to bring them together again in another book. And it happened naturally in No Way Out. It's a Karen Vale novel. DeSantos comes in, I don't remember what page, but partway through the first third of the novel. Uzi comes in somewhere between halfway and the two-thirds mark, and it just, they're wonderful together, and I love writing them together. They're all different. They all have their shtick together, and it's great. And so that's what happened with No Way Out. It wasn't trying to one-up Inmate 1577. It was just trying to tell the best story that I can. That said, absolutely, you are right. It is. I feel the pressure to write a book that's on par with the best that I've ever written. And each book, I face that pressure. So, but you know, it's a good pressure because I think it's almost a competitiveness with myself to, you know, it's a challenge to go do more, do better. You know, each time I think that's not possible because I put my all into every single book. But, you know, it drives me. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, we just sent out our review of No Way Out, which I believe it'll be in the October issue of the magazine. And, you know, we really don't give stars. But if we would, I mean, we would rate it 5 stars. And it was just one of those things where you can just see Karen Bale as a character developing even further and further, and the way that you're kind of able to not, you know, Karen's not stale as a character. And I think that that's the most important thing that you have to do as a writer, is to make sure that she's not stale. Because now you're into book five, and then you start getting into six, seven, and you try to make sure that every book is not only, you know, a Karen Bale book, but it's also a progressive book moving forward. And is that something that you think about as a series writer for authors that are thinking about being a series, that that's what you have to do with every book? Don't make it stale. Don't make it cookie cutter. Like we just had Stephen James on kind of saying the same thing.
Yep, you are, and I've spoken with Stephen about it. You are absolutely 100% right. That was my biggest concern when I started the Karen Bale series. In fact, I wrote The Seventh Victim, which is now the first book in the Karen Bale series. I intended that to be the only one. You know, to me, I was not interested in writing series characters because I'd read colleagues whose, you know, their series got very stale, their characters got stale. It was basically, you know, the same book rewritten in a different way or different setting, but right. It was the same story. And so when my publisher sat me down, this was in 07, and they said, Alan, we've had an incredible response from the sales reps and the buyers. The buyers work for the chain stores and, you know, the other wholesalers and bookstores. And they said, we love Karen Bale. When's the next Karen Bale book coming out? And my publisher said, you need to make her a series. And, you know, that was like... It was like poison to me. It's like, no, I don't want to write a series. But it's very hard to say no to your publisher. So I said to them, well, let me think about it. I'm not going to put my name on something that's not absolutely the best thing that I can write. I will not put my name on a piece of garbage just to, you know, say this is part of a series. And they said, well, that's good because we don't want to publish garbage. So we were, you know, in agreement on that. And I said, so let me think about it. And I thought about it. I spent a week thinking what are the best ways that I can keep Karen Bale fresh? And it wasn't so much as looking at an outline of novels, say, okay, I could do this with one. It wasn't like trying to come up with ideas for books at that point. It was the concept of how to keep Karen Bale and me. I mean, I had to keep me, Alan, as a writer, excited from book to book, as I talked about earlier. So once I figured out how to do that, I called him up and I said, okay, we're going to do this. And I have kept to that that idea that I came up with. That has been my mantra from book to book. And it's basically stressing the character, taking her out of her element, bringing her into situations and against villains, if you would, antagonists that challenge her in ways that she's never been challenged, or the setting, like England or the Napa Valley, or, you know, take your pick, all the, you know, Alcatraz, San Francisco. These are places that she's unfamiliar with or has difficulty navigating, whether it be because of the culture or, you know, the people that she comes up against or the areas. For example, the wine industry. She knew nothing about the wine industry. And it's, you know, it's kind of cliquish, and they have their history and their, you know, it's a small town mentality in a sense, if you could translate that into a business. And she had to navigate that while still, you know, trying to catch a very virulent serial killer. So these are the types of things that keep her fresh and challenge her. And also, as you said, she does evolve from book to book, and that's not an accident. I mean, there's obviously, right. I'm doing that on purpose, and it's subtle, but because you don't want to jolt the reader. And you don't want the reader to go, well, wait, this isn't the Karen Bale I know and love. You know, so you have to do it in subtle ways. And the best way to do that is, like you and I, learn and evolve over time from our experiences in life. That is how Karen Bale evolves. she has, for example, she's developed claustrophobia. Well, that came from something that happened in the seventh victim, and it's something that, you know, now it follows her, and she has to deal with in subsequent books. So that's an example, one example of many, of how she has evolved over time and experience from book to book.
And I want to remind everybody that we are speaking here with author Alan Jacobson and his Karen Vale series. No Way Out is book 5, just came out September 17th, and you can buy it in any format that you would like to read it in, and it is available now. So when you have somebody that's, you know, and you kind of get, I'm sure you get this question quite a bit, but when you always have, you know, we always have new people that are finding out about these authors, and they find out about Karen Vale, and they find out about you, and, you know, either you run into them in conferences or wherever you're at, or bookstores when you're signing, and they come up and they say, oh, gosh, you're in book 5? I mean, do I have to start at the beginning? What do you tell them about the series? Where can they kind of jump in and just kind of start running and really not miss a beat?
You know, that's an excellent question, and I am asked that. My answer used to be you can start anywhere, and as I get into now, I'm starting to write book 6, and my sense is that if you're a series person where you like to read series, it's probably best to start with book 1. If you want the full experience of seeing this development and advancement and growth of the character over time. And I've also tried hard to develop a family of characters, which is fun for me as a writer. And I've been told from all my readers that they really love the family that Vale has around her and the relationships that she has. So I think, you know, if you are looking at a series of books and you want to get the full experience, you start with book 1, which is The Seventh Victim, and then Crush, and then Velocity, which are kind of linked together, and then Inmate 1577. If you really want to get the full experience, you read Hard Target, because there are things that happen in Hard Target relative to Vale and DeSantos and Uzi that I build upon in No Way Out. And all of this, there's even a short story in there, Fatal Twist, that figures in to some extent, a small extent, but it's all part of the Karen Vale canon, so to speak. So when I'm writing book 6, which is going to be kind of, it's going to tie together in some way all the novels, all my novels actually, even False Accusations, which was my debut novel, and so far is my true standalone. There are no characters that appear anywhere in my other novels, but my plan is to bring one of the main characters from False Accusations into this, you know, 6th Karen Vale novel. So it'll tie together all my short stories and novels, and it's fun. It's, again, it's something
right,
new and different that I think the readers will really enjoy. So, you know, again, if you're looking for the full experience, start with 1 and move forward. If you're just looking for a really good read, and it doesn't really matter to you if you start somewhere, then you could start anywhere. There have been people who start with Velocity, but which is the 3rd book, but I would strongly recommend that if you're going to go that route, then at least start with Crush and go into Velocity, because those two stories are strongly linked. You can read Velocity as a standalone, and I wrote it that way so that somebody could read Velocity and come into it without having read Crush. But again, the full experience, Crush and Velocity were intended to be read, you know, one after the other. So, yeah, you know, it's a long answer to your question, but it's a good question, and it's not cut and dry. So, yes, you can start anywhere in the series, but for the full effect, start with The Seventh Victim and read through.
And when they get to, let's just say they go from book 1 and into book 5, how would you sit there and explain how has Karen, I guess, progressed as a character from 1 to 5? What's one of the biggest things that people, you know, will notice that have read the first 4 and now they're going to pick up No Way Out, that she's progressed or changed as a character?
Well, she had a tendency to be somewhat gruff. She had a bit of a chip on her shoulder, and that comes from, you know, kind of real life. And again, as you know me, John, I research very heavily each one of my books.
Yep.
And I really spent 7 years researching The Seventh Victim before I wrote it. I mean, it seems absurd and almost inconceivable to me now, but, you know, it is what it is. I really felt that I had to learn behavioral analysis and how the FBI profilers work and what they do and how they write up profiles and how they deal with offenders and so on and so forth before I could construct a story that was true to the subject matter. I wanted to write something that no author had ever written before. I had unprecedented access that no other author has ever had, ever. So it wasn't like I said, well, I have this access, I need to write something, you know, great. It was more like, this is just incredible, and it was exciting me so much that, you know, that's why I continued with it. It was just an eye-opening experience to something I had never experienced before and knew very little about, and I had this access, and I just couldn't get enough of it. And so, you know, I started off, Vail was based a lot on the real female. She was actually the second female FBI profiler. My understanding is the first one didn't last a long time there. So my work with Agent O'Toole, who was the second female FBI profiler, was extensive at times, and she was really helpful in helping me to understand what it was like for her when she first came into the unit as a woman. And that was, you know, who Karen Vail was in the beginning. And as the books proceed, we see somebody who is, you know, has dealt with these people in her unit. And there are still issues, but by and large, you know, she's kind of earned her stripes. And she, just like, again, Agent O'Toole, it was, it got to the point where, you know, she was able to be the one saying, no, this is how it is, and this is what I feel is happening, and you guys need to pay attention. And that's, you know, kind of what's happened with Vail. She's gained, you know, I wouldn't say star power, but she's gained respect in the unit. And so she has, in a sense, kind of softened from book to book. She's learned also that she needs to play well with others, and she didn't always do that. You know, she had this chip on her shoulder, which served her well at the moment, at the time, not only dealing with those who didn't wish her well in the unit, but also, you know, with the offenders, the killers. You've got to be able to stand toe-to-toe with them as a woman against a man who's, you know, this heinous individual, and hold your own and know how to deal with them and not be afraid. And that takes a special individual. And so that's who Karen Vail is as we, you know, touch with her in The Seventh Victim. But as the book moves, the books progress and move on in the series, we see that she learns that, you know what, she doesn't need to be gruff or tough with everybody. You know, she's still the same person. So a lot of her wisecracks and sarcasm are internal as opposed to directed at people. You know, we still see the same response, but she's learned to keep it within. Just like you and I. I mean, if we had to get along with people, you know, we would find ways to you know, be amenable and agreeable, and she has found that. So we see that progression from book to book, and her sense of humor hasn't gone away. It's just sometimes directed inward as opposed to outward. And so that's a big part of what I wanted to do with her. We see that she has learned some lessons. She made some mistakes in The Seventh Victim. She's a mother, and she made some parenting mistakes, and so we see that evolve. In fact, it isn't until Inmate 1577 that she owns one mistake that she made, and it hits her very hard because of something that happens in the novel, and she reflects on it. And I think this is the way life is. You know, we don't always assimilate things that happen to us and realize the impact until a year later, sometimes longer. And that's what I feel, that's what I always try to do with Karen Vale in all of these novels, is to keep her real. She's not a superhero. She makes mistakes, just like all of us do. But she wants to do well, and she does her best, and she works hard, and she's really good at what she does. But that doesn't mean she's perfect, you know? None of us are. So instilling that reality is so important, and part of that is the growth, our learning experience, when we realize, oh, crap, you know, I blew it there, you know, and I need to do it better next time. And she does, because she remembers what she did previously.
Well, we got about 40 seconds left. So let everybody know, like, the best way for them to maybe get in contact with you, whether it's email you or just you know Facebook, Twitter, or what else you got going on.
Absolutely. So my website, which is alanjacobson.com, alanjacobson.com, has my Facebook link, my Twitter link. I've got two Facebook fan pages. And you can join. One is Fan Run. One is, you know, the quote official one. And I'm on both. And Twitter, I tweet daily, and email me. So all those links, including the email, is on my website. You'll see something. I think it says Contact Alan, or, you know, something like that. It's pretty obvious. And there's a drop down menu with all the different choices. So, and we also have a free personal safety ebook that I co-wrote with one of the FBI profilers that we give away for free if you sign up for the newsletter, and we email you the free safety ebook. So it's chock full of important information to keep you and your loved ones safe. I highly recommend it.
Well, Alan, we want to thank you so much for coming on, as always. We can't have this big of a lapse the next time, though, you come on, so write faster.
You bet, John. I'm doing my best.
All right, Alan, you have a good one. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks, John. Take care.
All right, bye. So, again, everybody, that is Alan Jacobson, the author here of his character, the Karen Vale series, No Way Out, is book 5, and it is out now, and it came out on September the 17th, and you can find it wherever you buy books in any format you want to buy. And again, visit alanjacobson.com for a lot more information. And we are going to take our last break, and we're going to be back here with our next guest. Her name is Amy Lignor, and she is the writer of the Talent and Lowry series, along with a YA series that she does too. So stick around and hear that, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody, here to our last segment of Suspense Radio. First, let me just thank Stephen James and Alan Jacobson for being on the show. They've been always fabulous guests and always fabulous authors, and we want to, again, thank them for coming on together. First time I think they've been on the show together. That's been great. And now we are going to transition here into our next guest. Her name is author Amy Lidnor. She is the writer of the Talent and Lowry series. A lot of people know her maybe for her YA books and the Angel Chronicles that she has written. But two books now called 13 and The Sapphire Storm are really starting to pick up steam in this series. And we want to thank Amy for coming on and talking with us. So, Amy, how are you doing? Thanks so much for coming on.
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
So we're having you on a little late because The Sapphire Storm has already been out for a little while, and 13 came out, I believe, last year. But the series is starting to now kind of, you know, take on a little bit mind of its own. It's starting to, you know, pick up a little bit of traction. So why don't you go ahead and kind of take fans exactly what the Talent and Lowry series is, starting with book 13 and coming into The Sapphire Storm, because it definitely has a little different twist on what people might think of an adventure series.
Yes, it does. It is building, and I'm very, very happy about that, because it's not your typical, to me anyway, it's not your typical mystery series. It is very much a adventure, action, mystery, suspense, little romance thrown in, and you always have the sarcasm and the humor thrown in, which I always like to do, and I'm very excited about the main character. Leia Talent is the main character of the series, and she is the head of research at the New York Public Library. So she basically has the job that I would kill for, and she is one. I would live in their basement if they would let me. She is one of those highly smart individuals that has what you would call a card catalog in her own mind. She'd be the perfect contestant on Jeopardy because she has a lot of useless information in her head of all different subjects. And she's one of these women who loves her job, loves being in that library, but a little hard-edged, I guess you would have to say. I think you would... readers who love suspense would think of J.D. Robb's Eve Dallas in the respect of Leia. She's very funny, but she likes to be alone. And what happens to Leia in 13 is that she is down in her precious basement one day reading, as always, and she likes to spend her Sundays there just relaxing. And she comes into her library's basement, and a man is in the corner pretty much blowing up the cornerstone of the library, which was laid by Carnegie, or Carnegie, of course, funded that back in the early 1900s. Well, inside that cornerstone is a book, a very old book that only really gives pictures of things, and it's a mystery that he is trying to solve. His name is Gareth Lowry, and he is what you would call a wealthy man, but he is a person who may look like 007, but... he has a definite mission in mind, and he is the one that really starts this off. He does make her sit in her library for quite a while and listen to what he has to say, because she basically just wants to have him arrested and get him out of there. And Leia's mind has so much information in it that when she starts looking at this book that was inserted into that cornerstone by a group that was very, very real, that Carnegie was a part of, she starts realizing what some of these pictures are. And her curiosity, I think, is what gets the better of her here. And she is the one that reveals to him what that picture, the first picture, means. Now, she heads straight to the Winchester House, which is in San Francisco. And I should preface that all of the locations that I use are completely real. I am a research fanatic. I have to know what every room looks like. I have to know what every backstory is and mystery out there because, let's face it, there are millions that are based on the architecture and buildings and legends that we have. There's some very real places out there all, you know, in the world.
Right.
So I love using those. And what my brain does is I take a thread and I tie three places together that normally would not be able to be tied together. And in 13, the Winchester House, which is a ghost house in San Francisco, which did house a woman who, Sarah Winchester, who went a little crazy, I guess you could say. She
right.
kept building that house until she died, and everything in the house is 13. 13 steps here, 13 faucets, 13 everything. She was very obsessed with that number. And from the Winchester House, where they find something, Leia is able to put together the next clue, which leads them to Jack the Ripper World, on that street in a building that was still that's still there, a foundation that is still there that had something to do with him, where they find another clue. And oddly enough, that clue ties into the Last Supper, which doesn't make much sense to everybody. You got to read the book. But there is a thread that actually, yeah, people are saying you can't tie Jack the Ripper to the Last Supper, but it's the building itself. It's the architecture
itself.
Some people,
you know, believe me, some people can, and I can, so go ahead.
Well, okay. There is a thread that is actually very true, and even though the novels are all fiction, because I make up certain things, I guess you could say that's Dan Brown-esque, the places, et cetera, and the threads I use are actually true. I get a lot of great letters from fans that say, I ran to Google. The minute I read this book, I ran to Google to check this out, and oh, my God, it was true. You know, so
right.
that's always fun. And then they end up where they're supposed to end up, which is actually in England, which is a place mm-hmm. that I can't really tell or I'll ruin the end of 13. And
okay.
it ends very nicely. It's not a hanger. It's not a cliffhanger, number one, because I didn't really think I was going to continue with it until people started saying, well, I have to know more. I have to know what she would do next. And then the Sapphire Storm came about. And what's fun about these books is I get to introduce all these characters now and really delve into their lives and allow people to really get to know Leia. So the second book, The Sapphire Storm, started with Leia's actual family. She was taking Gareth Lowry home for Christmas. And of course she was laughing about it because she knows her family. So
right.
He was taken into a house that he was quite surprised by. You know, she said, you're bringing them a gift. She says in the book, you're bringing them a gift outside the house. And she starts laughing. And he said, well, you have a gift. And she said, well, yes, it's arsenic. I already know my family. So she introduces him to that clan, which is a whole lot of fun. But while they're there, he gets a phone call from his sister. And a new mystery starts. They have to help his sister. And how to do that is actually a puzzle that puts together Francis Bacon, who was actually the editor of the King James Bible. And that is absolutely true. And he has a tie to William Shakespeare. There are a great many people who believe Francis Bacon was actually William Shakespeare. So that actual clue tied to a place in Egypt, in Coptic Cairo. And then that tied to Petra, which I don't want everybody to think these are all biblical, because they're not. These are very interesting legends that actually can tie together. So it's more history and archaeology and just action-packed fun. And there are some, of course, biblical overtones, because some of these legends are locked in that type of history. So they do end up finding a very big thing that everybody wants to find in number two, The Sapphire Storm, and at the end you have sort of a cliffhanger, which is what brings us to The Hero's Companion, which is coming out October 22nd. So fans are going to understand what the cliffhanger is. And in the third one, it begins where Leia has to save someone this time in her own family that everybody's already met in number two, and she gets caught up in a whirlwind. I mean, you're talking about a treasure that is buried in Athens on the Acropolis that has a big thing to do with Athena, who is called in, you know, many places, the hero's companion. That's where the name comes from. And that one clue that she finds has them going to a place on top of a mountain that everybody knows pretty well, a monastery that everybody knows pretty well, and she falls into what you will call a garden. And let's just say in that garden there's a very big snake in there, and we're not talking about the Garden of Eden. And she finds a scroll that, again, is actually real and can be found in Egypt in a museum. And with that scroll, it gives her directions of something someone buried a very long time ago. And that scroll is found in Qumran. And it was found with all of the scrolls. Many, many years ago, they found scrolls and jars out there from the apostles and all kinds of people. So this is, again, actually real. But the thread that I used it to lace with everything also goes into Cleopatra's mines, which are also still there. So it's very much an Indiana Jones, and I really like that fact. But as the books go on, I'm loving the fact that we get to delve into her life and her family and opening the door for something that no one will guess.
Yeah, because besides the journey that, you know, that you're taking the readers on through, I mean, basically, you know, throughout history to four corners of the world and back and beyond, there is a, you know, a way of just trying to get to know the characters that you've, you know, had to weave in between all of that, and they're able to know. So when you're going with the hero's companion, have you kind of taken those characters and made it to where they are just, you know, a lot more than just the story that they're wrapped in?
Yes, that actually began with the Sapphire Storm, I have to say. 13, like I said, was an adventure book. There were great characters. People loved them. And then when they wanted more, I really started to delve into everything. So Leia's family came about, Garrett's family came about, and an interesting sideline of Leia being adopted came about. And in The Hero's Companion, you're going to find out a great deal between her father and her. And that really does lead you into a lot of secrets that are uncovered in her own background. So it's not just secrets she's uncovering as a puzzle or a mystery or to solve, you know, the crime and find the treasure. She really is, the book is really delving into her and secrets that come out about her past and her life that she didn't know, which of course allows Leia to become much closer to Garrus. So they become more of a team. She has someone to rely on in him. And even though she was sort of hard-edged at the beginning of 13, at the very beginning of these books, as she and he continue to do all this and find all these things and become closer and closer, as her secrets come up, then you can do a much more in-depth look, complex look at the two characters, which I'm loving. It is so nice to be able to explore Leia and explore Garrus and where they came from and how exactly they both ended up where they are. So as she finds things and he finds things, I get to have a second plot. I really get to have that second plot of personal things instead of, you know, the quest or the treasure or tying things together. I'm able to tie them together. And the characters come out as much more in-depth, and the readers are really loving that because they grab on to Garrus and Leia. They love the fact that they're together and that they, the way they talk to each other and the way he helps her through, because he's going to have to help her through a very large secret in The Hero's Companion, which also helps with the title. You know,
right.
She can be the hero and he's her companion and she can be the hero, you know, so either one can take on that role. And because of how much they care about each other, when these secrets come out and Leia, you know, it hits Leia personally, she has, you know, her companion. So
right.
It's great to be able to do both.
And, you know, a lot of people, you might not know, but you started off writing The Angel Chronicles, and it was a YA series that, you know, that you're into, and I think you have three books within that one. How are you able to kind of transition and tell those fans that were reading that this Talon and Lowry series is something that they need to be getting more involved in?
Well, I think the biggest thing for me is, A, the YAs, I had so many adults writing me about the books. You know, not mm-hmm. I had teenagers too, but a great many adults who said, oh, this is different. This is, thank goodness, no vampires, no werewolves, no zombies.
Young adults kind of like a very loosely terminology now, because, I mean, when you go
exactly.
watch the movies Twilight or anything else, it's these 40-year-old women that are watching Days of Our Lives and going over Taylor Lautner. It's like, dude, that's your son. Shut up.
I remember going to the Twilight movie with my daughter because she wanted to go, and there was a woman about two rows in front of us who was my age. And when Lautner came on the screen, she went, oh, and then she immediately went, oh, wait, no, oh, no. And she just bowed her head. And my daughter had to look at her, and she shouted over to her. She's like, he's 18. It's okay. So I was like, okay, well, adults are far more into this movie. But it was the same with the YA, the Angel Chronicles, except for the fact that I didn't do the werewolf vampire thing that was all the rage. And I don't do fallen angels where the devil is coming to take them and, you know, stuff
right.
like that. It was a real team. And I think that's where I got the idea for the really in-depth stuff with Leanne Garrett, because the team, the warrior and angel team that I have in the Angel Chronicles, that had to be very personal. It couldn't be just demons, devils, oh my. You know, I picked a subject and a way to tell it that used history, used present day, and mm-hmm. used two young people that were really thrown into something that they were trained for, but when they come down here, they really don't get it. I mean, it's much harder than just seeing a movie. They have to do it in real life now. And their relationship and how they developed over the past three books and how they've grown up and always were that team, even when they fought or had a bad day, they had to stay together because one without the other doesn't work. They wouldn't survive. So that really helped me with Leanne Garrett, because even though, of course, Leanne Garrett are much older, it's that same complexity. And I, instead of just getting stuck in the action adventure where it's one book and you're out and it wasn't that cute, it's now this long standing tale, because there's going to be seven of them, and okay. it's this long tale of really two very fantastic people, and women can understand Leia, because anybody who's gone through, I don't know, females who've gone through just regular life can
right.
can understand her attitude, her career, her desires, her needs, and also the walls she's put up. Because we all have them. And Gareth Lowry, I suppose, is one of those Mr. Darcy figures where you really need that hero. But just because he is the hero, you're the hero too. It's a nice balance. There's no, oh, I'm the male, so I'm the big guy and I'm going to win for you and you're the
right.
little woman. Leia is such a strong character. Again, I have to refer to Eve Dallas and Rourke in the J.D. Robb books. She's such a strong character that it completely balances out. No one's in the lead. No one's in the, you know, the one you're going to count on. They have this strength together that if either one of them were apart, it just wouldn't work. And that's what I like about it.
And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Amy Lignor. And the website you can go to is The Right Companion, WRITE, companion.com, therightcompanion.com, to find a lot more information about the books. So what's kind of the one thing when you know, when fans kind of read your books and they give you some feedback on that, what's one of the most asked questions that you kind of get that – you know, you can tell people, hey, you know, this is the answer.
Oh gosh. Well, when it comes, I get a lot of questions about history and the threads, and I have to lead them to the site. As people are Googling these things all over, I felt a little like Dan Brown when he came out with, of course, the one everybody loves more than life, the Da Vinci Code, and everybody started Googling the Last Supper. Even my mother, who is a career librarian, so you see where I get that from, she said people were coming into the library every 5 seconds to see the picture, to just figure out what he was talking about. So I get a lot of that, you know, hey, I just found this room. It's there.
And just to say about the Dan Brown, the one thing that they should have been doing was going to read the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which is the book that he used to steal our information from. Okay, go ahead.
That was a very good book, guys. Yes, it's sort of like when people, when I talk to people about Stephen King, who's one of my favorite authors, and Dean Koontz, they'll talk to me about The Shining, and I always say, don't watch the Jack Nicholson movie. Read the book or watch the miniseries with Stephen Weber that they did, because Stephen King actually did that one.
And then
that's what's true to the book.
And read Dr. Sleep, which just came out, which is Danny all grown up.
And I just did yesterday. And I had to. I had to. I had to put everything aside and say, oh, forget this. It's Stephen King time.
Yeah.
And I'll insert, it's a very good book, guys. If you're looking for scary, it's not as scary as The Shining. But like I was just talking about, he went very complex and into Danny so that you understand him and what happened back then. So anyway, the questions I get a lot are, I do get a lot that say, please don't kill Leia.
Okay.
I don't know if they're thinking about Harry Potter and they were afraid when Harry Potter was going to die. They say, please don't kill these characters. Please don't do it. You know, and you know, everybody wants a happy ending in number 7, but you have to understand that this is an entire journey with these two people. I've already written 5, and 3 is coming out now. So I'm on number 6. So I just have to let people know, you are going to go through a really big journey, and there are really big surprises, personally for the two of them and puzzle-wise. So just know that if you read one, there is another one coming. So you don't have to ask the questions till, you know, it's all said and done kind of thing. Not over. And that's what I love about it, because Leia, Gareth, once you get to know them, you want to know them all the time. I need as a writer to see where they're going so I can understand why everybody wants to know where they're going. And it's a great deal of fun to watch them.
And, you know, and the thing is that you live in like one of the most perfect conspiracy theory towns in the United States, in Roswell, New Mexico. I mean, is the alien there? Is the ship there? Did it land? Where did it go? So already you were kind of, your mind was already geared into that process of, you know,
history. Pretty much,
and all of those kinds of things. And that's where you get, you know, if you can see, that's as a fan and looking at from the outside, you can tell that's kind of where you get your, you know, your passion from. And when, you know, people hear you speak, you can see that there's a lot of great passion. It's a lot more than just saying, yeah, you know, I sat down and I wrote this really good book and you should really read it. And it's just like, really, you know, I mean, it's like they don't understand what they're trying to write. And that's what makes it really good when you find an author like yourself that's able to really have the passion and get into what they're writing, because that's what gives the fans that much better experience when they're reading it. And that's one thing I want to tell authors. Make sure that that's what you do when you write, that you put some of yourself in your book. Otherwise, it's just going to be another boring book, and you're going to get another D on your English paper. I mean, that's about all I can
say. Exactly. I have to eat, sleep, and breathe them. I mean, people always tell me, well, you write them. Well, my answer is always, and it may seem silly, but they write themselves. I'm on a journey. I'm sitting in front of a computer, and Leia and Gareth are in my head, and they are taking me to places that I didn't even know I'd ever be able to see. So I'm so into them and what they're doing that I get very, very lost in what I write. And that's why, I mean, when I get letters back from authors that, you know, I would never assume they would even talk to a schmuck like me. I got a letter from Dean Koontz, and I almost fell off my own chair, you know. And he said, he even mentioned Roswell, of course. He said, I am so glad that when our ship crashed, I was able to walk away. So he said, very excited about his career because it all began in Roswell as far as he was concerned. So, you know, you get these amazing letters, and I get these amazing letters from kids, too, about the angels that just touch my soul. I mean, I'm thrilled, and I feel so honored by it. With the angels, I got one from a little girl with brain cancer who said she is in love with them, and I got big posters made for her of the angels so she could have them over her bed. And you know, you hear something like that, and you just think, oh, my God, I was down here for something, you know, besides taking out the garbage and putting out the dog, which, you know, is very important as well. So,
well, I'll
but
tell you what.
With Leia and Gareth, I love them. I hope everybody gets on board because I think you're going to have a lot of fun.
Well, I'll tell you what. We want to thank you so much for coming on us. We are out of time for this radio show. And, again, everybody, therightcompanion.com, Amy Lignor, the books 13 and The Sapphire Storm are out now, so go get them. And Amy, thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me. Take it easy, John.
All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, we want to thank Stephen James and Alan Jacobson for coming on to talk about their books, stephenjames.net, alanjacobson.com, and now Amy Lignor, the book is 13 and The Sapphire Storm and the Talent Lowry series. Go to the right, W-R-I-T-E, therightcompanion.com for more information. Our next show is going to be on October the 26th, and that is going to have Tasha Alexander, Peter James, and Raymond Corey. But do not forget that you can also tune in to Crime and Science Radio, and that will be the next newest. It's going to be October the 5th. Doug Lyle is going to tell you everything you need to know about drugs, poisons, toxins, and death. And you can always go back and listen to the last show, which was The Sirens of Sherlock Holmes. So don't miss out on that on Crime and Science Radio. Again, everybody, we will see you all again October the 26th for our next show. If you have any questions, you can email radio@suspensemagazine.com. Until next time, goodbye, everybody.